Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
And welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. In this hour, we tackle issues in bioethics with Father Tad Poholczyk, one of the world's most helpful Catholics in this regard. Helps us all the time in thinking through bioethical issues and issues in the broader kind of ethical field. If you have questions about the moral implications of modern biotechnology in any way, we welcome that call today, maybe about having to do with birth or life before birth or with death and the processes of death or issues in the middle of life, treating disease, those kinds of things, experimentation, all those things that are really hot button issues of our time. Give us a call, 888-318-7884. You won't be sorry you did, because Father Tad Poholczyk will be, I can guarantee you, will be helpful to you. 888-318-7884. Father Tad is a priest of the Diocese of Fall River, Massachusetts, and the director of education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center. He holds a doctorate in neuroscience from Yale University because he couldn't get into a good school. Father Tad, I'm just kidding. How are you, Father?
I'm doing great. Good to join you, Cy.
Yeah, glad to have you here on Catholic Answers Live. I don't think I can allow this day to pass without asking you about baking cakes, because that's what everyone is talking about. The Supreme Court today heard arguments about whether a baker who has moral objections to marriage or so-called marriage between two men can refuse to bake a cake in celebration of that union. The arguments were hot and heavy, and they are difficult. They're not always straightforward and easy. But so I thought I'd ask you about that. I mean, what are the moral considerations, first of all, when we ask ourselves, can I do this for another person? Can I do this service, or am I crossing a moral line if I do?
Well, I think a lot of people feel that if they were put in that situation, that they would just have to do it, because if they failed to bake that cake, that they would be, you know, manifesting some sort of overt discrimination or racism, you know, against those with different leanings. And it's really not about that at all. It's not about discrimination or racism. It's about whether the government can force someone to do something directly against his own conscience. You know, I mean, I think there are, you know, parallel examples that help people to immediately tap into this violation of conscience. So if we say, as you and I were talking about just before the show, can a Jewish baker whose mom was a Holocaust survivor, can that Jewish baker be forced to decorate a cake covering it with swastikas and on behalf of a request from a neo-Nazi activist? You know, does that make any sense at all? And of course it does not. And of course that Jewish baker should not be forced against his conscience to use his special cake decorating talents, his artistic skills, to support something that he completely opposes. So, you know, there are these kind of contradictions that just immediately emanate from a case like this. I mean, you could think of it in another term. What about if you have some individual who works for the Democratic National Party and wrote speeches for President Obama, and he's a really skilled speechwriter, he's a really smart guy, and suddenly the government comes to him and says, you have to, in order not to be prejudiced against anybody, you've got to now write speeches for the Republican president, for President Trump. You know, that wouldn't make any sense again.
Right.
Or, you know, what about if you kind of flip this whole thing around? If you say, let's say you have the gay owner of a small website designing shop, and somebody comes into his shop and says, I want you to design a website for me that declares that marriage is exclusively between one man and one woman. You know, can you force the gay owner to do that if he doesn't want to do it? You know, that's kind of turning it around here.
Yeah.
And again, people can see that that just doesn't make any sense to be forcing people to violate their consciences, and to use their specific gifts, talents, artistic abilities, and so on to violate their own beliefs.
And yet, Father, can we also say with the same kind of enthusiasm or with the same clarity that it's not in most situations that this is not an issue that we're not saying discriminate against a gay couple, for example, if you know you're a doctor and somebody needs medical care, or you're a grocer selling groceries, or that kind of thing. Can we say that with as much clarity? And then what's the difference?
Well, I think the case with the doctors is going to require certain kinds of questions. Certainly if you have a gay individual come to you who needs to have their appendix out and you're a surgeon, I mean, of course, important for your work as a surgeon is that you have a human being in front of you who has an urgent medical need, and you simply, do that without any consideration of that fact. But this would change a little bit. In fact, would change significantly if you had an individual who came to you and said, and this man who was presenting himself to you said, "I want to become a woman. Please prescribe hormones to me so that I can transgender myself." Well, now that's something very different, and that's already not a valid medical request. That is a lifestyle request, that somebody wants to have this kind of change take place, and therefore they're trying to involve a medical professional who in conscience could very easily step away from that. The situation you mentioned about a grocer, if you own a grocery store, that's something that you open and provide food to people who need food and who can pay for it, and that's really the only criterion. You can't be, doing some other types of exams about them and then actively discriminating against them based on, for example, if they were gay or if they were pro-life or pro-abortion or anything like that. None of that is relevant to the enterprise of providing food. And morally, that's a good thing to do, to provide nutrition, make it available for people to purchase. And, one can't kind of get in there and turn this into some kind of ideologically laden undertaking. But that's different than being called upon to use your specific skills to support an agenda that you actively oppose in conscience. And that's what the baking the cake, the masterpiece cake court case is really about.
888-318-7884 is our number. Father Tad Paholczyk is our guest. Issues in bioethics is our topic. But if you have broader ethical questions, we certainly welcome those. Father's prepared to take those. 888-318-7884. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back with your calls for Father Tad Paholczyk right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Alexander Sample of the Archdiocese of Portland in Oregon. Keep that dial right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Christmas is coming, and with Advent already upon us, we want to make sure you know about our annual Christmas sale with hundreds of great faith-building resources, all on sale at 20% off when you enter promo code WINTER at checkout. With great new resources on Scripture, church history, the saints, Bible prophecy, and so much more, there's simply no better time to stock up on resources to build up your faith and the faith of those around you. Phone 888-291-8000 or go to the shop at Catholic.com right now to take advantage of what is truly the best Catholic sale on the Internet, going on now through the end of the year. And remember, enter promo code WINTER at the checkout to save 20% on hundreds of great resources throughout the store.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
At Christmas, who does not want to be the one who gives not just a gift that keeps on giving, but a gift also of lasting meaning? If you want to bring someone into a deeper relationship with Jesus Christ in a steady and nearly effortless way, get him or her a subscription to Catholic Answers Magazine. Until the end of the year, Catholic Answers Magazine is available for $10 off, and when you purchase a subscription, you get a subscription to the digital edition for free. That's right, $10 off a one-year subscription and 20 off two-year subscriptions, plus a free subscription to the digital edition. With a deal like this, Catholic Answers Magazine is the perfect gift for anyone who wants to learn more about the Catholic faith. Friends, family, high school and college students, seminarians, even your pastor. Catholic Answers Magazine will change the hearts of those who read it, and it will help them bring the gospel to others. Visit CatholicAnswersMagazine.com to sign friends and family up today. That's CatholicAnswersMagazine.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Father Tad Paholczyk, our guest this hour, issues in bioethics is our topic. If you have an ethical question, especially having to do with the beginning, middle, or end of human life, give us a call, 888-318-7884. Lots of calls, Father, so we go right to phones. Jacqueline in Ann Arbor, Michigan, listening to EWTN on Sirius Satellite Radio. You are on with Father Tad Paholczyk.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, Father.
You're welcome.
Can you hear me?
We can, yep.
Super.
As close to the phone as you can get would be great, Jacqueline.
I'm going to take it by speaker.
Oh, yeah, speakerphone is deadly. Now, did you just hang up on yourself? Okay, I think Jacqueline, I don't know what happened there. It seems that Jacqueline might have accidentally hung up on herself. I don't know if there's any ethical issues involved with that. You're permitted to hang up on yourself. Is that right, Father?
Yeah, I don't think there's any significant ones. That's perfectly fine to do, and it's probably unintentional as well.
No, good point. Intention matters in these things.
It does.
I think Jacqueline will call back. Rochelle in New York. Oh, excuse me, in York, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. You are on with Father Tad Paholczyk. Your question, Rochelle.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Happy to.
Can you hear me okay?
We can.
Okay, great. I have a question about end-of-life processes. If somebody's put on a respirator, like they cannot breathe without the respirator, and you put them on that, or maybe like a feeding tube or anything that helps keep them alive, without it they would die, are you allowed at some point to take them off of that, or do they just have to be there in that state with those machines until something else goes wrong with your body? That makes sense?
Yes, Rochelle. This is a common question that comes up. I think it's important to maybe separate a little bit of what you asked. You asked first about a respirator, but then you asked about a feeding tube. Those are very different interventions that can be used. But I think the question people have is sometimes it's before they've even done this. Then they'll say, well, gee, if I put my dad onto a ventilator, then once he's on, it means I can never take him off, right? And the answer to that would be no, that's not correct. When you make the decision to put somebody onto, let's say, a ventilator or a respirator, you have reached a conclusion in your thinking that, well, this ventilator is likely to help him, to have some benefit for him, and the burdens are not too great. That's usually the kind of thinking that goes on. That's the kind of thinking that should go on, where you say, you know, what are the benefits? What are the burdens? And when the benefits are greater, then you say to yourself, it makes sense to use this ventilator to help the person that I love. But it may happen that you put somebody onto a ventilator, and as time goes on, despite the ventilator, other organ systems are starting to shut down. Maybe there's some significant issues of discomfort or problems with the ventilator itself. For example, maybe they've got a lung that got punctured, or they're having some other complications related to the ventilation itself. And then you begin to say to yourself, gee, this is getting more and more messy, and the benefits now seem to be not as great, and the burdens are clearly becoming much greater. And especially if you're in a situation where death is approaching and is very imminent, and you're clearly out of other options for this person, then there indeed may be a point where you say, now the burdens are so high that it does not make sense for us to continue to ventilate here. And you could turn off that ventilator. And there would be something similar to jump back to your earlier part about the feeding tube. You know, normally feeding tubes are not a big deal, especially when you put them into the stomach directly rather than going through the nose and down the back of the throat. When you place it straight into the stomach, it's called a PEG tube. Those ones are pretty comfortable. They're easy to provide food with. But in some rare cases, you might have a situation where every time you feed the person, they start vomiting. Maybe there's some obstruction further down in their intestines. Maybe something else is going on, but you just can't stop the vomiting. Well, in a case like that, you'd say the burdens here are really high. The benefits are practically zero because he's not absorbing any of the food that I'm giving him. Am I required to continue to force feed him in this way? Probably not, if you can't figure out a way to stop the vomiting. So that's what you're doing, is looking at benefits and burdens, and there will be cases when you may determine that it makes sense to discontinue something that you started earlier, especially when people are dying and, you know, the whole scenario is changing rather rapidly in front of you. So I hope that's helpful, Rochelle.
Does that help you, Rochelle?
Yes. Yes, that is very helpful. That does add clarity. I was, like many people, I think I was told, once you're put on a respirator, you can't ever be taken off it, no matter what, until everything else just, you know, gives out on you. And I just didn't feel like that was right. So thank you for clarifying that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and, you know, I think another point to add to that, Rochelle, which, you know, people sometimes, when they struggle with that, they say, well, gee, if I turn off that ventilator here, then they are going to die in all likelihood. And that may be true, but this is something that is not sinful to do if you have carefully weighed those burdens versus the benefits, and it's clear that the burdens are much higher. This is what we call a heroic or extraordinary or disproportionate procedure. And in those cases, it is not sinful to stop providing that heroic or extraordinary intervention. So I think that's important for people, because sometimes they feel a little bit guilty. Gee, it seems like I shouldn't be doing this. But it is not sinful to do that when you have properly made this moral determination for your loved one.
Rochelle, thank you very, very much for that question. Does the calculus change, Father, when you're dealing with, say, a young, healthy teenager and maybe someone who is in very advanced stages of life, that maybe you would allow more suffering in the case of the teenager, given that if they do pull through this, there's a lot of life ahead for them?
Yes, potentially it would. And I think when you have a younger person, you're always saying to yourself, this person is likely to have more resiliency, greater ability to bounce back, more flexibility, and therefore, you know, we got to make sure that we're doing due diligence here in terms of taking care of them. While somebody who's much older and much weaker, you may realize that despite your best efforts, they just don't have that bounce back anymore. And therefore, you know, the assessment of whether it's disproportionate or extraordinary is going to be very different for somebody who's younger versus somebody who's older.
Thank you again, Rochelle, for that call. We go now to Malka in Indianapolis, Indiana, listening on 89.1 FM. Malka, your question for Father Tad Poholchik.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call. My father, who was 91 years old, passed away this morning. And my question is in regard to...
Malka, take your time. I'm very sorry on the passing of your father.
Yes, me too.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It was decided my sister, who is a nurse and also my father's designated health care representative, after meeting with hospice about a week or so before he passed away, it was decided that no one was to talk to my father about the fact that he was probably going to die within a week or so. And part of, I guess, their reasoning was that because he has a certain degree of dementia and very bad short-term memory, well, you know, he wouldn't remember it anyway. And so I guess, why bother? I don't know. This didn't really set right with me, but I was wanting your perspective on that.
Father?
Yeah, you know, this is a bit of a complicated question in the sense that there may sometimes be situations like you're describing where you want to provide comfort to somebody that you love. And part of the steps that may be required to do that may be to withhold certain information. And I think dementia is potentially a case like that. Or, you know, sometimes people, if you're worried that they have a tendency to obsess too much on certain things, you may choose to share information with them in a very measured fashion, little pieces at a time, rather than sort of giving them all the information at once. And I think, you know, there's always some judgments of the virtue of prudence here. And so, you know, if your family felt that your dad wouldn't be able to process this information in a reasonable way, that maybe he would get caught in some kinds of loops in his thinking, or you know, be very anxious and worried and not able to understand it, there might indeed be an argument to say, well, you know, just so that he's not in greater discomfort, we may choose to withhold certain kinds of details from him. But you do have to be careful there and make sure that when you do this kind of thing, that it's genuinely driven by the best interests of the patient and not by any other considerations. You know, sometimes there might be a concern that an individual, if they knew certain things, that they would make certain decisions on their own a different way than somebody else in the family who is, you know, trying to advise them. And so then you only give them partial information, and they can't make informed consent decisions. Well, that wouldn't be fair. But that doesn't sound like, you know, the case with your dad at all. It sounds more like, you know, there may have been some reasons not to allow him to get, you know, too worked up or anxious. But, you know, without knowing more specifics, I can't say anything more detailed than that. We have to kind of remain on the level of the general. And I would say simply, again, in conclusion, sometimes there may be a good reason for making a decision like that.
Malka, how does that sit with you?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly understand what Father is saying, that there would be occasions for doing that. I guess from the spiritual standpoint, I guess, you know, I would want a person to be able to kind of have some recourse before, you know, meeting death.
Yeah.
And if they don't know that that's imminent, then but
yeah, I think that's a fair consideration, Malka. I mean, obviously, when we're dying, it is a privileged segment of time in our life. And so, you know, I would say unless there's significant reasons for not sharing this, in general, our approach should be to fully disclose and let people make those needed preparations.
Malka, you can hear the music. That means we have to go to a break. Thank you very, very much for that call. And we will keep you and your family, and especially your father, in our prayers that he might come quickly home to the house of his father. We'll be right back with more Father Tad Pahulcik after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
At Christmas, who does not want to be the one who gives not just a gift that keeps on giving, but a gift also of lasting meaning? If you want to bring someone into a deeper relationship with Jesus Christ in a steady and nearly effortless way, get him or her a subscription to Catholic Answers Magazine. Until the end of the year, Catholic Answers Magazine is available for $10 off, and when you purchase a subscription, you get a subscription to the digital edition for free. That's right, $10 off a one-year subscription and 20 off two-year subscriptions, plus a free subscription to the digital edition. With a deal like this, Catholic Answers Magazine is the perfect gift for anyone who wants to learn more about the Catholic faith. Friends, family, high school and college students, seminarians, even your pastor. Catholic Answers Magazine will change the hearts of those who read it, and it will help them bring the gospel to others. Visit CatholicAnswersMagazine.com to sign friends and family up today. That's CatholicAnswersMagazine.com.
It might be said that anti-Catholic notions of the Church's history are the original fake news. With all the misinformation being spread, where does one look for the truth? In The Real Story of Catholic History, Professor Steve Weidenkopf gives you the facts on over 50 of the most common misconceptions about Catholic history and shows how to answer them simply and powerfully. Whether it's to answer claims about Catholicism's supposedly pagan origins, old myths about the Inquisition that never seem to go away, or more modern errors that anti-Catholics put forth, The Real Story of Catholic History is an essential resource for every Catholic's bookshelf. Order your copy of The Real Story of Catholic History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Anna Mitchell, host of the Sunrise Morning Show. Who prepares for Christmas better than a child? I think back to my eager anticipation as a kid. I couldn't wait for Christmas morning. Am I awaiting the newborn king with that same eagerness I awaited Santa? And not that Jesus is expecting cookies and milk, but how am I preparing my heart to make him feel at home? Every Advent, we have the opportunity to recapture that innocent spirit of wonder at his arrival. Let us pray today for such a gift. From all of us here at the Sunrise Morning Show, have a blessed and fruitful Advent.
Yes, indeed. Have a blessed and fruitful Advent. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. We're giving away a free book, The Case for Christmas, Answers to Attacks on Christmas. You get a free copy if you just go to our website, Catholic.com, click on the free ebook banner at the top, and you get to download your copy today. All various articles and chapters in there on various attacks on Christmas and how we Catholics respond to those. The Case for Christmas. It's free. It's an ebook. It's at Catholic.com right now. This hour, we have Father Tad Pahulcik as our guest. Father Tad is the director of education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center, a doctor in neuroscience from Yale University, and one of our favorite guests. And Father, a little earlier, Jacqueline dropped off the line, but I think she is back with us. We go now to Jacqueline in Ann Arbor, Michigan, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Jacqueline, are you back?
I am back. Thank you. I made it home and thought I'd try again.
I'm glad you did. You are on with Father Tad. Your question for him.
Super. Thank you. Don't want to be too long-winded, but the question I have is related to IVF. My husband and I had difficulty conceiving back in the 90s, late 80s, 90s, and went to our parish priests and asked about what options we have regarding IVF. And at that time, there was nothing really stated definitively by the church one way or the other. And his recommendation at that point was, well, they haven't said anything yet, one way or the other, so if you're going to do something, I would recommend doing it now. And, of course, that was before the Internet, before we had as many resources as we did now. So my husband and I were successful in having a child through the IVF method, and we had extra embryos, to say the least, that we tried again and did not have success. But we still had some frozen embryos that we have. I mean, we consider them our children. And it's been probably almost 20 years that they have been in the frozen state. And I guess we're at a crossroads. I'm past childbearing age and don't quite know what ethically we should do. And I thought this was a perfect time to call in and possibly get some assistance with this.
Father?
Yes, well, this is a very important question. And, you know, I'm glad to hear you refer to those embryos as your children, because, of course, that is what they are. And it's a difficult situation, I think, for couples who have gone down this path, sometimes, as you yourself are pointing out, with erroneous advice that they received from a priest. I've myself have, you know, run into this on multiple occasions where people would say, yeah, we asked our parish priest, he said, just follow your conscience, just do whatever you think you need to do, everything will be fine. And, you know, often not being well informed on what the church actually does teach, this ends up generating these awkward situations. And so, you know, to give you the short answer here, there isn't any clear, simple resolution to the situation you describe of having children of your own who are trapped in these frozen orphanages, and having some way to do something other than to keep them frozen for the time being. It's certainly never allowable to hand them over to researchers who would then destroy them and get stem cells. That's obvious, I think, and goes without saying. But sometimes people wonder, well, what if I have a younger sister and she's still fertile, and she's offered to implant and gestate these embryos and raise them as if they were her own kids? You know, would that be okay? The church, in its most recent document called Dignitas Personae, came out of the Vatican a few years back, maybe eight years ago or so, has very strongly cautionary language against this. It doesn't say it's always wrong, but it's clearly, even though it's not a bright red light, it's what I call a yellow light, saying, whoa, you know, be careful here. There are a lot of concerns. So the church seems to be moving in the direction, in my opinion, of saying that this embryo adoption idea would not be acceptable. The church hasn't actually said that yet, however, so technically it remains open and still debated among Catholic theologians. So that's theoretically a possibility. Sometimes people will also ask, you know, is it okay just to thaw out the embryos and let them die? And I am convinced that that would not be an allowable step. And sometimes the way that's argued is people will say, well, you know, they're in liquid nitrogen, and that's not a very natural state for them. So it's a little bit like an extraordinary means, and therefore it should be okay to take away the liquid nitrogen and let them die, kind of, you know, analogous to some end-of-life scenarios. But the problem with that, that's not actually a sound way of reasoning here. First of all, these embryos are not actually at the end of their lives. They're at the very beginning. And secondly, the term extraordinary is a moral term about burdens. And if you ask yourself, okay, what are the burdens that the embryo is suffering by being held in this state of cryopreservation? Practically none. The embryo doesn't feel anything. There's no pain. There's no suffering that we know of. There's nothing. The embryo is simply held in that state. So no burdens, really. And you can say, well, what about the burdens to the family? They do have to pay a fee every year to the company that's keeping them frozen. But what I often say is that's not actually a big burden when you consider what it is to raise children these days. Of course, there's expense associated with that, and this is only to the tune of, you know, $300, $400 a year to protect your children. So I don't think that the argument for taking them out and thawing them, I think it actually is an act of causing their death and shouldn't be counseled as a general answer. So just to wrap up on this, I mean, when I have people who come to me and I'll say, they'll say, what should we do? And I'll say, well, there isn't a simple answer. There's no clear answer. If I were in your situation, I think what I would do is I would set up a small kind of fund of money, maybe a trust fund, something like that, so that the small fee each year could continue to be paid, maybe even for, you know, a few years after I'm gone, just to kind of show the seriousness of my intention to protect my children. You obviously can't do this forever, but to do that as a sign of one's, you know, regret for having caught the children in this dilemma, and to do one's best then to continue to care for them. And I've worked with couples who have actually done that. They have set up trust funds so that when they themselves die, there will still be something for, you know, another 10 years or maybe 20 years. And part of their thinking is maybe possibly there will be some answer in the future that will be available that will allow for those embryos to be rescued. But at the moment, there doesn't seem to be. There's also this question that comes up, will there ever be an artificial uterus or some kind of machine that could gestate our babies? And would that be, you know, would that even be ethical? I think that, you know, many people, many thinkers find fundamental moral objections to that as well. So this is a very complicated question that you've raised, as you can tell from the way that I've tried to answer it, but recognizing that there's not a simple answer to the case.
Jacqueline, your response?
Well, you know, we have been at the point where it's been a good 20 years that we've been paying on our children. And I wish at the time we had gone ahead and done all of them at once and taken a chance that we would have had many children, but we didn't. And I guess we'll just continue, like you said, until maybe there'll be some answers in the future and there'll be some definitive statements from the church on the best way to handle this. So that was helpful.
Yes.
And I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, thanks for sharing your experience with the parish priest as well. One of the things that I do is I travel around the country and I speak with different groups of priests. I go to different dioceses and they'll have like a convocation of all their priests. And I will bring up these kinds of cases with them and say, you know, look, this is part of the reason it's important that we all get informed on this and even that we preach about it sometimes so that our people, you know, are not left unknowing, unawares of these very, very important questions, because it can end up in a very difficult situation, much like you and your husband find yourself in at the moment. So, you know, I have the sense that a lot of priests are becoming aware of this and are kind of, you know, tuning in more fully to what it is that the church teaches on this important area.
Jacqueline, thanks very, very much for that, for sharing that call with us. I think you have stirred something that will be very, very helpful to very, very many people. And we'll certainly keep you and your family, your children, in our prayers. We have to go to a break now. Father Tad Pahalchuk is our guest. We are talking about issues in bioethics, and we'll be right back with more of that after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Pope Francis said, "All of us are called to mature in our work as evangelizers. We want to have better training, a deepening love, and a clear witness to the gospel. St. Paul Street Evangelization's online school of evangelization will equip you with the tools you need to be an effective evangelist. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you're unable to give, we'll set you up for free. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Just like the saints of the Counter-Reformation, our own souls are in constant need of reform, of reconversion to God and His will for us. We struggle with sin. We become distracted in prayer. We find it hard to be loving and easy to be selfish. In Reform Yourself, Sean McAfee shows you how these magnificent saints can be guides to your own personal transformation. We all need to reform our souls. Let the saints who reformed the church show you how. Order your copy of Reform Yourself today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpin. In Matthew 15:29, from a mountainside near the Sea of Galilee, Jesus cured the lame, the mute, and the blind. He told his disciples, "My heart is moved with pity for the crowd, for they have been with me now for 3 days and have nothing to eat." So from a few fish and 5 loaves of bread, he proceeded to miraculously feed the crowds with 7 baskets of food left over. Surely most of us have been fed with him for more than 3 days. Daily he feeds all of our needs. Yet we tend to dwell on what we don't have and still want, without regard for our lack of gratitude. We seldom think of ourselves as being ungrateful. Yet most of our thoughts are all about us. Conversion means centering on Him instead of ourselves. Let us make sure that today we thank Him for who He is and for our awareness of Him. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Father Tad Pahalchuk is our guest this hour. It has been a 2 hours of priests today, but then we just had a whole bunch of future priests just come through the studio, the Norbertines, the seminarians from just north of us at the Norbertine Abbey at St. Michael's, where our own chaplain, Father Hugh Barber, comes from. And boy, he was proud of those young men. You could see it in his face. He's proud of his seminarians. That was very nice to have them visit. Father Tad Pahalchuk is the director of education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center, and that's what we're talking about, issues in bioethics today. We go now to John in Portland, Oregon, listening on 88.3 FM. John, your question for Father Tad Pahalchuk.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question is, and it may sound a little strange, but why does death have to be repeated at all?
Wait, hang on there, John. We have, for some reason, everybody's really far from their phone today. I don't know if you're actually underwater, but if you can get as close to the phone as you can, it would be really helpful because we're having a very hard time hearing you.
Is that better?
That is better. Hello? Yeah, you surface for a minute.
Okay, sorry about that.
Nope.
I'm taking the word sickness as a movement towards death. If you're sick, that means if you don't do something, you know, you're moving towards death. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yes.
So
why does, my question is, why does sickness have to be resisted? If we look at Jesus, he was, when he was called to go into, and he was going to be nailed to the cross, that was certainly going to make him sick. But he did not resist it.
Right. He didn't resist it. But notice, if we're going to use Christ here as the paradigm, one of the most important aspects of what Christ did was exactly and precisely to heal all forms of sickness, even raising people from the dead. So the imperative to resist sickness is something very deeply ingrained in our instinctual respect for life. It's a basic human need and desire to sustain life, because life is a good. It's a great good. It's one of the greatest goods. And in fact, it's such a great good that we hope for a resurrection of that same life eventually. So while we're here on our journey, we do have what we call duties or responsibilities of stewardship. And I think stewardship is really the key word that probably answers your question, that we've received life as a gift, and we have certain duties towards that gift. And those will extend during the length of our journey, but there will clearly become a point at which the effort to maintain life and the burdens associated with that will become so great that it will be heroic, and then we will no longer have that duty to try to sustain and continue that life. And at that point, we properly accept that our own mortality will cease, our life will end, and we move on. So, you know, I think the Lord's case is something, when he freely accepted the death that was coming, that spiritual attitude is a correct one for all of us. We should all be able to say, however it is and whenever it is that the Lord God himself determines my time is up, I will accept that. I will fully accept that. And I think a lot of people don't do that. They'll say, I'm going to fight to the bitter end. I'm going to, you know, no matter what, I'm going to defeat this disease. I'm going to defeat the cancer. I'm going to defeat this or that. And that's not a healthy attitude sometimes if it's taken to a kind of extreme there. So there does need to be an acceptance that we will all die, and a proper preparation when we sense that those end times for ourselves are approaching. But there certainly is a real duty in the interim during our journey to be good stewards, to exercise stewardship over the beautiful, beautiful gift of life that we have all received.
Does that make sense to you, John?
No, because Jesus was 33 years old, and he's at the height of his physical health. And if he took stewardship, and I'm willing to hear your answer that maybe he had different reasons, but all he had to do was walk in a different direction and not turn himself in. To me, based on your answer, he should have taken stewardship and walked in a different direction.
Okay, John, Father?
Yeah, I think Jesus manifested a perfect stewardship of his life in the sense that he was entirely at one with his mission and calling. And, you know, it turns out that some of us in our lives will get, for example, cancers when we're young. And to have that oneness with acceptance of that's our fate, well, it was part of the divine plan. And Jesus announced this himself ahead of time, way ahead of his own death. He was telling his disciples, this is the plan for me. And his disciples were saying, no way, you know, you can't do this. And he said to them, get behind me, Satan. So the point here is that the duty of stewardship is going to be nested within the broader mission that all of us have received. And Jesus was a very, very unique and particular one that did include the recognition that at age 33, he would freely surrender his life, and that was indeed his time. And he had the capability of actively knowing and discerning that without any error. you and I, you know, we tend to have to work through these things more carefully and under the impetus of grace and separating out a lot of self-seeking and, you know, selfish motivations and so on that tend to cloud our own perception of our mission and our calling in the Lord. But to the extent that we live in total oneness with that mission, there indeed may be some elements in that broader design that God has for our lives that will entail for some of us an earlier death than might otherwise seem from a human perspective to be correct. So the Lord, you know, is a very special case, and he handled it. He handled his own end in perfect synchrony with the designs of his Father who had sent him among us.
John, thanks very, very much for those calls. We're going to move on and try to get as many calls as we can in by the top of the hour. We go now to Tom in Indiana, watching on YouTube. Tom, you are on with Father Tad Boholczyk.
Thanks for accepting my call. I have a question because of an earlier caller reminded me. Before I was Catholic, I had a belief that I was not going to be the reason that a machine would live. That when it was my time, it was my time, so I was going to sign a living will and it would constantly be in effect. How did I rectify a living will?
You mean to make it in conformity with
that's
your...
That's a good question. I mean, living wills are often presented as special tools that we can use to prepare, to do advanced planning for our own sickness and death eventually. And so they're a tool to specify certain things ahead of time. And the question is, do living wills make sense? Are they a good way to do this, a good way to plan for our own future? And the way I'm going to answer that is I'm going to say there's a better way. What is the better way than a living will? The better way is to designate a real living person, someone that you're close to, someone who hopefully loves you, someone you trust, and say to them, I designate you, and actually do it in writing, sign a sheet of paper that indicates they will be your proxy, which means your healthcare power of attorney, or your surrogate is the other way we sometimes say it. That's a great way to make preparations. Why is it such a good way? Well, because if you just try to do a living will and sit down and imagine what's going to happen to you 10, 20, 30 years in the future, it really is just an exercise in imagination. It may have nothing to do with the actual sickness that you eventually end up getting. There's something unrealistic about that. If you choose a real living person, however, and then you become, let's say, unconscious, so you can't make your own decisions, that person steps in, talks to your healthcare team, talks to your family, talks to others who are involved, and makes a rational, intelligent decision and remembers conversations that they had with you when you were still conscious and seeks to also respect your intentions as they make decisions on your behalf. So that's actually the best way. Choose that surrogate or healthcare power of attorney for yourself rather than trying to write everything down in a way that ends up being perhaps restrictive, perhaps not corresponding to the actual sickness that you later get. And also, you know, sometimes by the time we actually get older and have a disease state, our views on things may change from our younger years when we were vibrant and strong and we had the whole world in our hands and we just said, well, if I get sick, I just want to die quickly. And we realized, no, there's more going on here. There's a process to my dying and graces that will accrue, and so I need to work with this process.
Tom, thank you very, very much for that call. Thanks to everybody who called today, and most especially thank you to you, Father Tad Boholczyk. It's always a great hour when we get to spend that hour with you.
Thank you so much. Great to join you.
You can find the National Catholic Bioethics Center at ncbc.org?
ncbcenter.org.
Well, we're out of time. Gotta go. See you tomorrow, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.